Thanks for listening to Other People's Flowers. If you'd like to have your work featured on the program, please send it to editor@otherpeoplesflowers.com. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Michael Anthony is a writer and artist living in New Jersey. He has published fiction, poetry, illustrations, and photographs in literary journals and commercial magazines. Most recently, these include The Furious Gazelle, the Northwest Indiana Literary Journal, and The Regal Fox. The American Labor Museum exhibited Michael's photojournalism essay, Middle Ends, on the waning textile industry. The Squall. It was sweltering for mid-June, and folks around Jackson County were wondering what August was going to be like if it was already this hot. As Joe McKee would learn, high temperatures weren't the only strange things happening. Ready for their annual camping weekend, Joe and his schoolmates waited outside Zach Shelby's house for George Wardlow and his father, who would drive them to the cabin Zach's uncle owned on the shore of Lake Cumberland. The Greyhawks, as the boys called their group of six, had packed enough food for a week, even though they were only going to be there from Friday morning to Sunday afternoon. Bobby Breckenridge brought a compass and his dad's squirrel rifle without permission, of course. Joe McKee carried his pa's hunting knife. Will Muhlenberg had a bow and six arrows tipped for deer slung over his shoulder. Not to be outdone, the boy everyone called Useless Hamburger packed a boning knife and a slingshot. That wasn't his real name, but having been baptised Ulysses Ambergy, it didn't take long for classmates to stick him with that onerous moniker. By now, he even used that name. With the boys huddled in the back of the truck, Henry Wardlow headed southwest. About an hour later, just as they rounded Indian Lookout, Will Muhlenberg yelled, "Stop!" The truck was still rolling when Will jumped and tumbled down the grassy slope on the side of the road. No one had ever seen Will run as fast as he did that morning. He dove straight for a bramble bush beneath some hickory trees. His pants were already round his knees. The other Greyhawks hung over the side of the truck, knowing exactly what was going on behind the quivering leaves and limbs. Mr. Wardlow called out the side window. "Green apples or chaw, boy?" "Chaw," the weak voice yelled back from the bushes. It seems Will had tried his daddy's Red Man chewing tobacco, and not having mastered the physics of it, swallowed more than one should. With his backside all scratched from the blackberry prickles, Will was pretty quiet for the rest of the ride. When they arrived at Lake Cumberland, Mr. Wardlow said, "I'll be back for you boys around 3 Sunday." Zach led them over 2 round tops, which separated the cabin from the road. Standing on that second hillock, they saw the large blue body of water. The hills to the north ran right to the shoreline. On the south end, a small sandy crescent formed a beach. Directly in front of them, and smack in the middle of the lake, was a hemisphere of rock topped with a grove of maple, some southern pine and one immense spruce tree that towered 60 feet above the others. "Look, an island," Bobby said, pointing out the obvious to his laughing friends. "It's called Dunbar Island," Zach announced while unlocking the cabin door. In minutes, the Greyhawks had stowed their supplies, picked out their bunks, and launched the skiff in the water. "Hey, watch it," Will yelled, complaining Zach was splashing him. "Relax, you should be thanking me for cooling you off. Gotta be 95 easy. What with the sun reflecting off the water, more like 100, Useless added while surveying the shimmering surface. Bobby tried to keep his daddy's gun dry. "Hey," he said, "you think anyone lives on that island?" "Nah," Zach laughed. "Ain't big enough. Sides, come fall, it practically disappears with all the rain in these parts." "Hey, Zach, how many does this boat hold?" Will asked. "Why?" "Because we're awfully close to sinking," Will said while gauging the few inches between the top of the rowboat and the lake surface. Useless swung round, shouting, "Sink? I can't swim." His hands lunged for the side of the boat. The sudden, jerky movement set the boat rocking, and with each list to the side, more water spilled in. Though it wouldn't actually send them under, to Useless it was the Red Sea closing in on the Egyptians. He wailed and flailed about until George elbowed him hard in the ribs. "Why'd you do that?" Useless panted in short, painful gasps. "'Cause if I hadn't, we'd all be in the water," George shot back, "and you can't swim." The unsteady boat was a good 100 yards offshore when Bobby hollered, "Geez, look at that!" Joe turned to see a black cloud so large and conical that at first he thought it was a distant mountain rising through the blue summer haze. That meteorological mass seemed to grow right before Joe's disbelieving eyes. The boat cut an arc through the water as an ebony curtain approached the lake. The threatening shadow swallowed the verdant hilltops, turning the Kentucky landscape grey as though caked with coal dust. By now, the entire western horizon was black as midnight. Along the line where sky met earth, blue-white fingers of lightning clawed the darkness, trying to hold back the looming evil. "We better get to the island quick," Zack yelled. "Don't want to be out here when that hits." Those forks of lightning now reached into the roiling, murky clouds. A clap of thunder that sounded like a canvas circus tent ripping in two echoed across the lake. Eustace and Will pulled hard on the oars. The others switched their attention from the menacing clouds to the island that still seemed far away. Shadows raced over the open water and neared the boat. A vast umbra soon enveloped the entire lake, dropping the temperature a good 10 degrees as wind gusts. Another thundercrack, followed by two even louder ones, had the Greyhawks desperate to reach the island for what little shelter it might offer. An explosion rivaling a fireworks finale boomed overhead. Instantly, everything blanched a ghostly violet. The boat, the boys, the water, even the trees along the shore glowed, all lit by 100 million volts of electricity. That eerie ribbon ripped the leaden sky. Everyone in the boat trembled as their skin tingled and their hair stood on end. Convinced they were going to die, Eustace and Will fell to the floor of the boat and curled into fetal positions. Zack and Joe grabbed the unmanned oars. No sooner had that frightening display of nature's fury sailed over the boat than a second bolt skipped across the lake. It first hit the shore, hopped some 100 feet up in a great arc, and then bounced off the surface twice more before striking a pine tree on the island now less than 50 feet away. The tree vaporized. Smouldering wood splinters and burning pine needles sizzled as they hit the water. Joe had visions of a lightning bolt crashing square down into the boat and sending pieces of the boys in every direction. He thought, by the time the catfish finish eating the tiny bits of flesh, there won't be anything left to identify. Hail, rain, and what felt like pebbles stung the backs of the Greyhawks, then ricocheted off the boat bottom. The rat-a-tat-tat of those minuscule missiles, the cracks of lightning, the rolling thunder and howling winds were deafening. Mouths open, but not a single word could be understood. Joe turned to gauge how much further it was to the mound in the middle of the lake. Instead of being close to its sandy shore, they had been blown towards its rocky edge and gnarled, half-submerged tree roots that littered the island's southern tip. Joe quickly realised that beaching near those rocks would be tricky in good weather. Doing it in this storm could be lethal. "We gotta get round or we'll hit the rocks," Joe screamed in Zack's ear. The louder Joe yelled, the less Zack seemed to comprehend. Filling with rain and water from wind-whipped waves, the boat was less than 20 feet from the rocks and closing fast. Another white-hot flash exploded in the lake beside the rowboat. Eyes were blinded, ears rang, and bones vibrated from the concussion. Dead fish dropped into the boat. Joe yelled, "You guys okay?" Unable to hear any reply, he felt around until his hand touched someone's arm. The boat slammed into the island and launched Joe into the water, missing the razor-edged rocks by inches. Upended, he tried to find the lake bottom. The water was chest-deep, but the waves made him bob like a sightless bird. With each successive crest, Joe swallowed more water. One particularly strong wave thrust Joe into a jagged boulder face-first. He clutched the rock with one hand, while his other felt warm blood running from his nose. Weakened, Joe slid back into the lake. Another wave forced him below the surface. Suddenly, Joe was being pulled up from the sandy bottom, lifted clear out of the water, and rested atop a rock. Joe figured it was his pal, George, dragging him to safety. Joe yelled, "That you, George?" He squinted across the surface in search of his friends. The broken remains of the rowboat's bow stuck up out of the water like the ribcage of a mythical creature. Another bolt of lightning ripped overhead and landed amid the stand of trees on the island. The air reeked of burning wood, tree limbs snapped, and the cracking of a tree trunk rivaled the wind. From nowhere, an arm locked around Joe's neck and pulled him back into the water, shoving him below the surface. Joe fought to free himself, but couldn't get more than a few inches above the surface, now darkened by branches of that fallen tree. Through the tangle of limbs, Joe saw who had pulled him back into the lake. It wasn't George. The bearded face was much older. Thin white hair barely covered a skeletal head, from which eyes blazed like pools of molten gold. Instead of teeth, only bare gums gleamed. The figure, which wore a plaid shirt, simply vanished beneath the surface. Joe pulled himself out of that godforsaken lake and scrambled over the slippery rocks. "Where are you guys?" he yelled. "Over here, by the trees," George bellowed. Still unsteady and squinting, Joe asked, "Everyone here?" "All but useless." Will shouted no more than 6 inches from Joe. "We got to find him," Jack said anxiously. "He can't swim." "Wait," Joe warned. "Someone's out there. An old geezer with long hair and a beard tried to drown me. He was over there by that tree, laying in the water." "I didn't see anyone," Will said. "Me neither," Zack agreed. Bobby lamented, "Wish I had my daddy's rifle." "Where is that thing anyway?" Joe asked as blood from his nose turned his chin red. "Probably at the bottom of the lake," George complained. That's when Joe realized his hunting knife was gone too, most likely lost when he slammed into the rocks. "Come on," he said, "we got to find useless." The boys worked their way down the rocks and scoured the surface as sheets of rain assaulted him. Joe prayed silently he wouldn't see the floating, lifeless curve of his friend's back or that old man who tried to kill him. He didn't, which both relieved and frightened him. I found something, Zack hollered from his perch on the rocks. There, snagged on one of the fallen tree limbs, was a brown leather work shoe that rose and fell with each wave. The boys knew it belonged to Useless because he was the only one with feet big enough to fit his daddy's shoes. Bobby cried. Zack looked as though he was about to lose everything he had eaten in the past few days. The others stood in the pounding rain, stunned at the disappearance of their friend, Useless. None had ever seen anyone die. Infirmed grandparents and aged distant relatives were expected, but certainly not one of their own. Not a greyhawk. Driven by fierce winds, the rain made it impossible to see more than 20 yards across the lake. Will screamed, "There he is!" But it wasn't Useless. It was that old man unfolding himself from a crouched position some 2 dozen feet in the water. Seeing him standing in his clothes, clinging to his body, it was clear it wasn't just his head that looked skeletal. Like strands of barbed wire, his unusually long and bony fingers reached out towards the greyhawks. Instead of approaching the boys, he spun into the storm and unleashed a shriek that challenged the winds. With his mouth agape and arms thrust out horizontally, Joe thought the old man looked like the crucified Lord himself. The man stepped towards the island and then thrust his arm down into the water until it was shoulder deep. It resurfaced instantly, holding something. "He's got Useless," Joe screamed. The old man held the boy against his side, bent at the waist, arms dangling like wet long johns draped over a clothesline. Pushed by the wind and rain, he waded to the island, where he eased Useless onto the ground. "Your friend needs help," the man said. "You killed him just like you tried to kill me," Joe yelled. "Had I wanted to kill you, I surely had me chance. Especially you," the man said, singling out Joe. "I be the one who hauls you out of the lake." "And you pulled me back in," Joe argued. "If I hadn't, you'd be lying underneath that spruce over there." The man pointed to the tree split by the lightning that now lay broken across the rocks and in the water. "If you want your friend to live, come no closer." His tone was menacing. Then the old man leaned over Useless and put his mouth to the boys. Gushes of air, followed by unintelligible words, could be heard through the momentary lulls in the hammering rain. The old man pushed on the boy's chest, alternating with breathing and speaking into his mouth. He kept at it for a good 10 minutes. The old man broke away and stood over Useless. Raising his arms and turning his palms upwards, he aimed directly into the pounding rain and chanted, "Come, squall, take your power and leave only peace. I command you, give back this boy his breath. Sea ana mangil." As the man incanted those 4 strange words, the wind seemed to lessen, the rain decrease, and the sky lighten, A single shaft of yellow sunlight broke through the steel-grey canopy and shone on Useless as he lay at the old man's feet. "Look," Bobby shouted. A million glistening diamonds spiraled down in eddies that never once went outside the ray of sunlight. Those luminous flakes settled on Useless and the ground around him. Snow so pure that it didn't even look real blanketed the boy. "Incredulous," George said. "Snow? Snow," Will repeated. A gleaming shawl draped the old man's shoulders as he intoned "Sa anam angil, sa anam angil." The snow stopped as quickly as it had begun. So did the rain and the wind. Along the western horizon, a band of blue summer sky chased the trailing clouds. The raging storm was gone, replaced by a quiet summer afternoon returned. Yet not a single bird called. There was no hum of dragonflies buzzing the surface of the lake or distant echoes of dogs barking in the hollow. The world had gone silent. A choking gurgle broke the unnerving stillness. It was Useless, alive with water gushing from his mouth. "Useless," George Wadlow shouted. The weakened Useless lay on the ground, moaning. What happened? "Got caught in a wicked thunderstorm. Boat sank," Zack told him. Still coughing and trying to reinflate his lungs, Useless sat up after some minutes. The old man aimed for the small stand of trees on the island. "Hey," Bobby Breckenridge called out. "You got a boat?" "Nay," the man said, "have no need for one." "How do we get back?" Zack demanded. The man growled. "Walk." Will yelled, "Can't walk on water, you old fool." "'Tis the only way. I don't see no bridge," Zack said. "You be wanting to go?" the old man asked. "Yeah," Joe snapped. "Then I be wanting something from you," the old man said. "What?" George barked. "A name. What name? Each who wants to walk back must give me your word that one child born to you will carry my name." "Ain't none of us old enough to marry, so how do you know we'll even have kids?" Joe countered. "Each shall father children. Name one for me and you can walk across the water. Have I your word?" "What's your name?" Joe said. Will thought he heard Jerry. Bobby heard Jimmy. George swore it was Jeremy. So did Jack. Joe was positive he heard Jamie. Useless wasn't sure of anything. The boys looked at each other. With no other way to get off the island, Joe told the old man, "Okay, we agree. Now tell us how to get back." "Can I tell you?" "Wait a minute," George challenged. "You said if we agreed, you'd tell us." "I can only show you." The old man walked into the water until he was knee-deep. "You coming?" "That crazy coot thinks we're going to follow him into the lake," Will whispered to Joe. "If you want to go back, then yes, you must follow me." Joe was stunned the old man could hear Will's hushed words from such a distance. "You best come quick. The path narrows, so step exactly where I do." "Are you going?" Zack asked George. "Do we have a choice?" he replied. "We can stay here," Bobby suggested. "And live on what, pine cones?" Zack scoffed. "Look," Will said, "let's stay back about 20 feet. If he tries something, we turn around and swim." "What about Useless?" "He can't swim," Bobby added. Joe McKee wrapped his arm around his friend. "I got him." The Greyhawks formed a line behind that old man as he pushed through the now calm water. Zack whispered to Will, "I think we're on a sandbar." The unseen underwater trail ran south before curving west. Not once did the water go above waist-high on any of the boys. Halfway to the shore, the old man called out, "Still agree to our bargain?" The boys shouted their assent and were soon on the shoreline, not 20 yards from the cabin, half-hidden by a cluster of white birch. "Tempt not the power by breaking your word," the old man cautioned, before walking back into the lake towards Dunbar Island. The sun warmed the boys, while the temperature returned to normal, at least normal for Kentucky in June. That old man stopped halfway across Lake Cumberland, raised his fist to the sky and howled. A fork of lightning broke from the dark clouds, brooding on the eastern horizon. That lone bolt dove straight into the lake. An explosion of water, electricity and sound erupted where that old man stood. He was gone. Useless wasn't quite right after that day, and his friends eventually started calling him Yuli. The rest of the Greyhawks seemed no worse for wear, except for Joe McKee's broken nose, Zack having to pay off a new rowboat by working on his uncle's dairy farm till school reopened, and Bobby Breckenridge having to tell his pa that his squirrel rifle was at the bottom of Lake Cumberland. The Greyhawks never went camping again, and disbanded after graduating Jefferson High. All but Yuli went off to colleges throughout the Ohio Valley. Despite promises to stay in touch, like most folks, they didn't. So, Joe never knew if the others kept their word to the old man. 27 years later, Joe McKee returned to Kentucky on his way to visit a college in Virginia with his daughter. Aside from a new gas mart, out along the highway and a larger high school, for the most part, the town of Greyhawk looked much the same as when he left. Joe pulled into the gravel parking lot of Ambergie's Hardware. His daughter peered up from her phone and asked, "Why are we stopping here?" "I knew somebody who worked here. Won't be long," Joe told her. "I'm not staying out here by myself," the girl said while stepping from the car and following her father. Time was frozen inside the hardware store. The same old signs hung on the walls. Metal loaf pans held myriads of wood screws, sheet metal screws, and lag bolts. Corn brooms stuck out from an old whiskey barrel in all directions. To Joe, the only thing new was the most recent layer of dust. The man behind the counter lowered the newspaper and studied Joe with a wary eye. "Yuli?" Joe asked. "Yeah?" "It's me, Joe McKee." Ulysses Ambergie's face went from cautious distrust to a wide grin. "Joe McKee? Where you been?" "Living in Ohio now," Joe replied. "And," Yuli said, his face still beaming, "this young lady must be your daughter." "Yes, that's..." Before Joe could finish his introduction, Yuli said, "Jamie, right?" "How did you know that?" Joe asked his old friend. "Easy. Them golden eyes of hers gave it away." Yuli then turned to the girl and smiled. "Bet you get an inkling when a storm's coming, huh?" Wondering how this man, unknown to her before this day, could divine something so personal and accurate, Jamie started to ask, "How do you..." Joe McKee rested his hand on his daughter's forearm. "I'll tell you when we're back in the car."
Other People's Flowers was produced by Hugo Gibson, Chris Kamonvutitam, and Hamish Adam Cairns. If you'd like to have your work featured on the show, please send it to editor@otherpeoplesflowers.com. Thank you for listening.